Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Welcome, welcome. Glad to have you here again on the regular Thursday noon Eastern time in the U.S. Every Thursday with Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. Co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brock. Debbie is traveling this week and hopefully tuning in, but not able to co-host today. Debbie, if you're out there, we're glad to have you at least tuning in. This is Alan Phillips, vaccine rights attorney, here talking to you from North Carolina here in the U.S. on January 10th, 2013. With me today, filling in for Debbie, is Rich Roberts, manager of the Pandemic Response Project. Rich, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Alan. Thank you for having me on. Good afternoon. I hope you're doing okay.
Doing fine. Glad to have you here filling in with us. And, boy, we got a lot to talk about today, Rich. May have to reel each other in on some of these items so that we can get to at least some of them. As is the case often on this weekly show, a lot of the topics we talk about come from news articles that are linked from the Pandemic Response Project's news page. That's the words Pandemic Response Project, all spelled out, pandemicresponseproject.com. And then there's a link at the upper right-hand corner of every page for the news page. And, Rich, the amount of news that keeps flowing on the vaccine issue has just amazed me, especially in the last few days. I think I put up three or four new articles just in the last 24 hours, 36 hours. It's just amazing what's been going on. But I wanted to dive into something really quick that just came to my attention this morning, Rich. Had a call from a woman in South Carolina that I spoke to some weeks ago. South Carolina is one of the few states that still has a vaccine religious exemption law that is, by its design, violates the federal constitution by requiring membership in an organized religion. And the woman got back to me and said that she had been inspired or empowered by my conversation with her, that she went to the Rutherford Institute and to a state representative, and they were able to get the health department to actually change their form. Now, that's a step away from, a big step away from actually changing the statutes, which are, in my opinion, unconstitutional and need to be changed, but that's a step forward, that the health department is no longer, apparently no longer requiring people there to be members of an organized religion in terms of the form and the design of the form. Now, I saw this a few years ago in Iowa, which, if they have the same law, last time I checked, it, again, was another one of the few states that still has a law requiring membership in an organized religion, which violates the Constitution. And they had a form, health department form, that was not enforcing that part of the statute. So, again, these are positive steps in the right direction. Of course, we need to follow up and actually change the statutes. That's a hard thing to do politically, of course, because the fallout from the pharmaceutical industry and state health authorities will be, oh, but that's going to invite more exemptions, and that's going to kill everybody and so forth, put everybody at risk. But we need to keep pressing our state representatives to fix and correct unconstitutional laws. And boy, I keep hounding on the enormous one we have right here in North Carolina, Rich, where we've got a law that allows children of any age to consent to any vaccine and other medical procedures, blatantly unconstitutional. That particular law, in my assessment, conflicts with at least four state and federal constitutional provisions and four state and federal statutory provisions, and was supposedly enacted for a reason that is already addressed in other laws. And so I think it was all, frankly, just a pretense. They were claiming it was about helping abused children, so of course all the representatives will jump on board to that right away. Oh, we don't want to be seen as not helping abused children.
Right.
But that's not what it was about at all. But anyway, good news from South Carolina. And one of the articles posted recently on the Pandemic Response Project news page, similar steps going on in South Dakota now. There's a representative there who is looking to fix an unconstitutional law there concerning vaccine religious exemption as well. So small but proud steps going on around the country as we speak this afternoon, Rich.
Well, very good. That is good news from South Carolina and South Dakota. And, you know, it might not be that huge of a victory, but, you know, we need every small victory that we can get. And, you know, it's just, it's affirming to hear that people in their states are doing as we're doing in North Carolina, Alan, and starting to, you know, initiate grassroots sort of efforts to get the laws changed and approach their legislators. So, you know, one day at a time we go forward from here. We're not going anywhere on this fight, so.
Yeah, really good point. And just a quick reminder to folks that the National Vaccine Information Center has what they call an advocacy portal, NVICAdvocacy.com, NVICAdvocacy.com. Anybody can sign up for free, and it's a way that you can follow vaccine legislation in your state and around the country, whether it's pro pharma or pro informed choice. You can stay on top of that. So while we need all the people we can who have the time and motivation and energy to spearhead legislative initiatives, you can be directly involved with a minimum of time and effort by just joining the NVIC's advocacy portal. So I'm a big fan of the portal. I'm actually the director for North Carolina for that project, proudly so. And I work with legislative activists around the country, so I'm hoping to be providing input in South Dakota and South Carolina to help get these laws changed. Meanwhile, Rich, we're gonna, you and I and anyone else here in North Carolina who wants to help us, let us know, because we want to move forward on the problems that need to be fixed right here in our own state, North Carolina. Rich, I understand you've been looking at some of the news articles. You got anything that jumps out at you as a good starting place for a conversation today?
I do. I have a few articles earmarked here that I think will be of interest. And I did notice, I went out there this morning and saw that you had posted a half a dozen new articles, which I haven't had the chance to review. So, but this is still very timely stuff.
The news is just flowing a mile a minute, and I keep expecting it to slow down or back off, and it just doesn't. This is a topic that just has constant new information. But go ahead, Rich. Take us on a trip here on some of the current news items.
Okay. Well, the first article here that really caught my attention, this is from BackTruth, and the title of this is 40 Children Paralyzed After New Meningitis Vaccine, which is just a horrifying title. This article is by Christina England, but I'm sure you're aware of this, but just kind of for our listeners' sake, let me kind of read into the background of this. On December 20th, 2012, a vaccination tragedy hit the small village of Goworo, which is located in northern Chad in Africa. And according to the newspaper, La Voix, out of 500 children who received the new meningitis vaccine, which is called MenAfriVac, at least 40 of them have become paralyzed. And the same children suffered hallucinations and convulsions. And the authorities in the area are shaken as citizens have set fire to a sanitary administration vehicle in a demonstration of their anger at government negligence. So a really horrible tragedy in Chad, Africa, Alan.
And this was a new vaccine, I believe, wasn't it?
Right. MenAfriVac is a new vaccine manufactured by the Serum Institute of India Limited. And there's information here, not from the manufacturer, but from the Meningitis Vaccine Project, that this is the first vaccine that has gained approval to travel outside of the cold chain, meaning that they can transport it without refrigeration or ice packs. So, you know, that should, it's designed to save money, you know, that would be spent kind of trying to keep the vaccine refrigerated during the last mile of delivery. And there's similar information, you know, that this vaccine doesn't need to be refrigerated coming out of the World Health Organization and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But surprisingly, if you actually look at the information on the manufacturer's website, and that's the Serum Institute of India, they're saying something quite different than that. And under their storage specs, they say that this vaccine should be transported between 2 and 8 degrees Celsius and protected from the light. So there's a discrepancy there in how this vaccine should be handled, and that might have, you know, a lot to do with why there was such a horrible adverse reaction. But it is, you know, a new vaccine, and these are side effects, you know, that we don't generally see associated with the meningitis vaccine.
Boy, I just, you know, paralysis can be temporary or permanent depending on the cause and nature in individual cases, and I don't guess we have information yet on that. We'll have to see how this plays out over time, but it is most disturbing to hear these kind of effects. I mean, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is, well, if they had done proper studies, they would first of all know that that's a potential side effect, but to hear
right.
about confusion about storage and delivery, I just don't see an excuse for that. I mean, I know the people involved are human, people make mistakes, but there is not room for this kind of mistake in the medical profession. There's not an excuse that, oh, we got confused about the storage temperature. You know, that's the sort of thing that you cannot be working with people with that level of incompetency in this profession. But it just sort of underscores the larger point, of course, that we make all the time, Rich, is that this is anything but the exact science that health authorities keep pretending over and over it is, that, oh, you get a shot, nothing, no problem with the shot, you're protected from the disease, end of story. It just doesn't work that way. And this particular instance, I think, to the best of my knowledge, is an isolated instance in terms of the particular effects. I don't recall hearing about paralysis as a side effect from vaccines, at least not in this sense. But in a more general sense, it's more of the same. We keep hearing this over and over again from around the world. People should have the right to make an informed choice. And, boy, two keywords there, informed and choice.
Right.
And
hello.
We just really don't. Hey, Debbie,
hey.
Is that you?
Yes, this is me. I've tuned in. I want to let you know that I am here and listening in about the meningitis, and there's a meningitis vaccine project that you can learn about also. There are, they say, periodic waves of meningitis epidemics occur across the sub-Saharan Africa, supposedly wreaking havoc in the region. Studies indicate that epidemic meningitis has been present in Africa for about 100 years, and it is most prevalent in the sub-Sahara. They call it the meningitis belt, which stretches from the west almost all the way over to the east in the center of the country, where you see Senegal, Gambia, Guinea, Liberia, and then all the way over Mali, Niger, Chad, Sudan, and then a little bit of Ethiopia. But my curiosity was why it is that they would be vaccinating children in particular. Why is it that that age group needs the vaccine? And is it only for, you know, this, let's see, on Wikipedia, it explains that the meningitis is an inflammation of the protective membranes covering the brain and spinal cord, known as the meninges. And the reasons for the infection can be virus, bacteria, or other microorganisms, less commonly by certain drugs. And some forms of meningitis also come from meningococci, Haemophilus influenza type B. So, you know, we are always concerned about the flu, the pneumococci, which would be pneumonia, or the mumps virus. Just a little medical kind of background as to why we would be seeing or needing to have a vaccine against this particular illness. And that's my curiosity.
Well, then, of course, this is a similar thing that we see with the flu, in that there are many different sources for meningitis, and the vaccine is, of course, addressing some small percentage of them. We hear that issue come up with the flu vaccine. We hear that come up with the Gardasil vaccine, that the strains addressed in the vaccine are a small percentage of the total number of strains known out there. And here we have not just different strains, but you have both bacterial and viral meningitis, and then non-germ causes of meningitis as well. And there are several things in this particular situation that's really stood out to me as problematic. Obviously, the ones we've already talked about, but then they said it took over a week. There was only one doctor in this area, and it was over a week before any of these paralyzed children could get to a doctor. Why in the world would you administer vaccines, a new vaccine in an area that was anything other than the opposite of that kind of a situation, so that if there were some sort of unexpected effects, you know, you got a new vaccine, you be extra careful with it when it's new, because there may be things that didn't come out in the testing that show up in the real world. So it just seemed like, why would you do that? And then there were parents who were paid money to keep quiet, basically paid hush money. Let's not let this, you know, get out. Let's not let anybody actually find out about this problem. In defense, of course, or cover up of the problems with vaccines to protect the vaccine program. But, I mean, this is really circular reasoning. You know, we don't want to have anything negative about the vaccines get out, because then people won't vaccinate and we need the vaccines. Well, if there are serious problems with the vaccines, maybe we don't need them and this stuff does need to get out. But by protecting, by covering up the problem, suppressing that information, keeping it out of the mainstream media, you perpetuate the problems. So even if there was merit to the larger vaccine program, you don't facilitate the positive aspects of that by covering up the mistakes or the problems. You need to do just the opposite, so that you can perfect or improve at least whatever the current vaccine program is, assuming, again, that there's merit there in the first place, which I frankly have my doubts at this point. But really disturbing, multiple aspects of this that were disturbing. The side effects, the fact that this was done when and where it was done in the first place, the delay in getting medical attention to these children, and then the attempts to pay off parents to keep the whole thing quiet. All of it deeply disturbing.
Right, Alan. And another disturbing thing is these children were evacuated to a hospital in the capital city of Chad, which is 300 miles away from where this happened. And so that has to be really traumatic as well for these children and their families. I mean, they have completely traumatized these people. And another big question that this article brings out, and we've talked about this before, Alan, too, and it's why do they push vaccines so strongly in a country like this, which just lacks, you know, basic amenities like clean drinking water, basic sanitation? This article points out that Gavi Alliance was a major financial partner in this project, and that it cost $571 million. So why do we spend $571 million on a vaccine project instead of digging a drinking well for these people, you know, which could possibly be done for $3,000?
Yeah, I think it's probably a lot less than $500 million, isn't it, to dig a well? I'm not an expert on that, but I'm guessing it's less. It's, you know, thank you, Rich, because I was thinking about that a few minutes ago and it slipped my mind, and it's I think, perhaps one of the fundamental issues here in this particular story is that if you took care of these basic underlying conditions, that in and of itself would reduce disease phenomenally.
We've seen that all over the world
through history.
A well will cost you $10,000. I'm just looking it up. The cost of drilling a well, water will vary depending on where you live. Obviously, maybe in Africa, the water table may be down lower. If you want to drill the well by hand or machine, or what type of material you choose, A general pricing expectation is $12 a foot. You may need 400 to 500 feet in depth. If you want higher quality materials like galvanized steel for your pipe, it might add to your cost. Well, the well could cost $10,000. Now, what if we spent money training people in those areas how to drill wells and provided the materials and the tools? There, that could go a very long way.
Yeah, but Debbie, you're amazing. Thanks for getting that information to give us some, you know, clear objective perspective on this. It's the critical concept here is to invest in the infrastructure and in the sanitation and education about those things, and then you take enormous pressure off for anyone to need to bring in any sort of extra or extraordinary medical procedures, techniques, what have you. And it's not that, of course, we need good medicine around the world as well, but of course, with very inexpensive homeopathy, you can avoid the need for much more expensive and oftentimes more problematic pharmaceutical approaches as well, too. All of which speaks to that the underlying motives here are clearly not about maximizing the health and safety of the people involved.
Exactly.
You have to wonder at a point if it's not even just the opposite of that. But clearly, that's not the goal. But let's push on, because there's so many other interesting topics here. And I wanted to jump in real quick here, Rich, if I may. I had some questions off air from a chiropractor in California. Now, we've been talking at great length in recent weeks, and I'm sure the story will continue, about healthcare workers around the country being required to get flu shots through the fall and early part of this year as a condition of employment. The pleasure, frankly, of working with about 150 healthcare workers in about 25 states this past fall, I was just really inundated with people looking for ways to legally avoid those shots and keep their jobs. But one doctor asks, is a hospital, if they don't offer a religious exemption at all, are they in violation of Title VII? And he's referring to Title VII, that's Roman numeral VII of the Federal Civil Rights Act, that requires employers to accommodate their employees' religious beliefs and practices. And this is a law that gives a lot of employees around the country a legal ground for refusing what's an otherwise mandatory flu vaccine as a condition of employment. And it's a real interesting question. It's parallel to the question of, do states have to offer a religious exemption for students in school, for example, for parents of kids in school? And in both instances, I think the answer to the question is no, you're not required to offer a religious exemption. And that, to me, makes it really intriguing that 48 states do offer a religious exemption, because none of them are actually required to offer that under the Constitution. When I say I offer a state exemption, I'm referring to exemptions for students. Because a lot of people confuse those laws. The state exemption laws usually don't have anything to do with employees, and so you can't use your state's religious or philosophical exemption to refuse vaccines in the workplace. The vast majority of the time, there are not state laws addressing that issue. But the fact that you don't have to offer it, and hospitals, I don't believe that Title VII requires hospitals to offer the exemption. What I understand the law to do is, when somebody asks for a religious exemption at work, that triggers the employer's legal obligation to accommodate the employees, is the word in the law, to provide a reasonable accommodation. But I don't think they have to offer it. So it's a real interesting point. So most hospitals, in my experience, do offer some kind of religious exemption. So far, most of them have been designing their own policies without looking at the law, and they end up overstepping legal boundaries, having unlawfully restrictive religious exemption policies. But nonetheless, similarly, states around the country, most of them offer religious exemptions for students, even though under the Constitution they don't have to offer it. But once they offer it, they have to offer it within the boundaries of the law. So, hopefully short, not too wordy answer for that one. Question, does a hospital have to offer a religious exemption? Are they in violation of federal law? No, they're probably not. But when somebody asks for it, they have to allow it according to law. And if they do offer an exemption, their policy has to comply with the proper boundaries of federal law. Rich, what else have you got for us in the news world here?
Well, just following up on what you're talking about there with mandatory vaccines and hospitals, I did earmark the article from ABC News entitled Eight Hospital Employees Fired for Refusing Flu Vaccines. And this one was by Sydney Lupkin. And you're quoted in this one, Alan, which is another reason why I wanted to talk about this article. But just to take a look at the human side of these issues. An Indiana hospital fired eight employees, including three veteran nurses, for refusing mandatory shots, stirring up a controversy over which should come first, employee rights or patient safety. And Ethel Hoover, who was a veteran nurse of 21 years, wore black on her last day as a nurse, and saying that she was in mourning for being fired and that she felt like it was her body and she had a right not to take the flu vaccine, and that she hadn't taken a flu vaccine for 21 years. And she did file two medical exemptions and a religious exemption and two appeals, all of which were denied. And a fellow nurse, Casey Davis, was on record saying that she and her colleagues were horrified over Hoover's firing, calling her their go-to nurse. And so it's just sad to put a human face on this and see, you know, good people are just being trampled in the process of these mandates.
Well, this is a real interesting case. I spoke with Ms. Lupkin, the woman who wrote the article, and she was absolutely wonderful to talk with and very pleasant, and I just really appreciate her writing the article, bringing the attention to people around the country that this is going on. It's interesting to me that this particular article or this particular incident is the one that caught national attention. There was, as we talked about, I think probably early on the show, there was a hospital in Ohio that actually fired 150 workers who refused to get the flu shot. And there have been firings all around the country, and some of them are, you know, catching the news locally or otherwise, and others aren't. But it's kind of tricky. Let me see if I can – this is involved here. Let me see if I can give a thumbnail sketch. A lot of people in this arena and in vaccine exemption arena, in the broader vaccine exemption arena, in schools or military, immigration, other places, a lot of people, when you're in a situation where you have to state what your beliefs are, a lot of people will, operating from a very reasonable, common-sense place, will say things that it turns out can backfire on you. And the single biggest, what I call, pitfall, legal pitfall that people wander into are the ones who, and this is very, very common when people approach this on their own, that they will talk about vaccine safety and effectiveness. Well, that's a sure way to get rejected, and I know at least some of the nurses who have gotten rejected have included those kinds of concerns in their statements. Now, these, of course, are well-founded concerns. There's plenty of objective information, published medical literature, studies, statistics, so forth. Information right out of the mainstream that underscores the fact that a mandatory flu vaccine policy just doesn't make any sense. And you can expect anytime you're in a situation where your beliefs can be scrutinized that if you talk about vaccine safety and effectiveness, they're going to disagree with you. They're going to say the vaccines are safe and effective, you're wrong, and they're also going to say that this is not a religious objection, this is a medical or scientific issue, and so they're going to reject you. And that's probably what happens many times when people who are claiming religious objections end up not being allowed the exemption. The other complication is one I already mentioned, is that most hospitals implement policies that are overly restrictive, that unlawfully restrictive, and so there's two huge hurdles there. So I keep saying this, and I know it's I have a personal conflict of interest here, or professional conflict of interest here when I say this, but I just don't know any other way to get it out there. It needs to be said that anytime you're in a situation where you have to state your beliefs, talk with an attorney who's experienced in this area. That would pretty much be me and very few other attorneys, because there just aren't attorneys who focus on this area of law, and none in the country other than myself who has it as a exclusive focus in my practice. But there are pitfalls to avoid, things that can backfire on you if you do what most people do when they approach this on their own, things that people do or don't do or say or don't say that can work against them. It's just the way the law works in this area is just not consistent with most people's common sense approach to it, and so a lot of people will get themselves into trouble. The ABC article, Rich, has gotten me a lot of feedback. I'm really grateful for everyone who has called and emailed me. I've had calls coming in on my old and new phone numbers and old and new email addresses about this, and a lot of people have been sending me information. Here are the problems with the flu vaccine. Hopefully this will help you with your case. And I wanted to say three quick things to all of those people, in addition to I'm really grateful for the just had a small outpouring of support for me and these nurses, and just on behalf of myself and the nurses, want to thank everybody who was part of that. Really, we really all really deeply appreciate your support. Folks know, first of all, these are not ongoing court cases. These are issues concerning religious accommodation in the workplace. And if your employer refuses to accommodate your religious beliefs and practices, your legal option is to file a complaint with a federal agency, the EEOC, which is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And it's really up to the commission at that point to decide whether or not to get involved, and if so, what they want to do. Now, if the EEOC either declines to get involved at all or gets involved and doesn't settle the matter to the employee's satisfaction, then if they wanted to sue the employer, they could. But it's really kind of pointless to go that far with it for most healthcare workers, because even if you go to court and win your case, and that's a huge if you get through the EEOC and the EEOC hasn't resolved it, then you very likely have an uphill battle if you decide to go to court. But even if you go through all that and you win, most healthcare workers around the country are what are called at-will employees. They can't be fired for an unlawful reason, but they can be fired for no reason. So you win your case, you get back to work, and 2 weeks later they say, we've decided to let you go. And the whole thing was for naught at that point. Unless, of course, you're independently wealthy, you don't mind spending the money, and you're trying to generate some legal precedent, maybe that would be helpful for other employees in the future, and that's a hypothetical positive outcome. But even that's risky, because you never know what you're going to get in court until the judge makes his ruling and or her ruling, before up to that point, it's always a roll of the dice to one degree or another when you're in court. So maybe not the best way to go, but a better place to go is to our state legislators and to insist that laws be passed based on the science or lack of science, and not to allow the politics to dictate policy and law. People's health and safety in the vaccine world keeps taking a distant, I think, for the most part, backseat to the political agendas of enriching the pharmaceutical industry and who knows what other agendas that may be playing out behind and underneath that as well. So we've got corrupt political systems in place. We've got to expose the corruption and bring some healing to our medical and political systems so that we can start putting health and human needs first above pharmaceutical profits.
Well, Alan, that was really nice what you just said, and thank you. And since this is an ABC article and this is such a feather in your cap, I do want to take a moment and read the relevant portion of this out loud and get your response. It says here, Alan Phillips, yours truly, who represented several nurses at the Indiana hospital, says his clients had the right to refuse their flu shots under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits religious discrimination of employees. Religion is legally broad under the First Amendment, so it could include any strongly held belief, he said, adding that the belief that flu shots are bad should suffice. If your personal beliefs are religious in nature, then they are a protected belief, Phillips said. Phillips, who is based out of North Carolina, has made a name for himself fighting for employees' rights to get out of mandated flu shots, but he has never needed to go to court. Although he usually handles a couple dozen health care workers per year, he had 150 this fall in 25 states. So hooray for you, Alan.
Well, thank you, Rich. I really appreciate that. Yeah, the article had originally credited me, attributed me to representing Ethel Hoover, and that was actually not the case, perhaps a misunderstanding on my part. But in any event, not misunderstanding in terms of who I represent, but in terms of the communication with the article author there. But I did represent several. I did represent several nurses at the hospital. And, yeah, I mean, these cases are ones that usually, the vast majority of the time, of course, you know, the ones that are going to make the news are the ones that don't succeed. But the vast majority of my clients around the country were successful, which has been the case the past couple of years that I've been doing this kind of work. This year we had to pull teeth a few times. There were about, give or take, 9 or 10 times where I had to write to hospital CEOs in order to get someone's attention. The hospital administrators dealing with the flu policy are not interested in many of them. Now, many of them have been very cooperative right up front, so I want to be clear here. While the majority of hospitals have been implementing policies that are unlawful, many of them have responded very quickly and appropriately when I've brought that to their attention. It is disturbing to me that condition happens so commonly in the first place, that they ought to be running policies past their own attorneys before they implement them in the first place and not require me and my clients to go through steps. But many of them have responded very quickly and made positive changes, and I've actually had compliments from some hospital attorneys about my own legal analysis and information I provided them. And when you've got somebody on the other side reaching out and shaking your hand like that, it really helps me to reinforce that my own understanding of the law and the work that I'm doing. But some hospital administrators have really dug in their heels, and we had to, you know, just basically wanted to ignore an 8-page attorney letter explaining the law and their risk of federal investigation and liability. I have discovered when you put that in front of a CEO, it gets very quickly to the hospital attorneys. And most of the time, when it gets to a hospital attorney, then a positive change follows. So, you know, every situation is different. But on the whole, we have succeeded in changing policy in hospitals around the country and in creating a path there for people's civil rights to be honored and respected. But just another follow-up comment, Rich, on this issue about vaccine safety and effectiveness, because there's a general proposition that is reasonably seen as a medical or scientific issue and not a religious issue. But under Title VII, there's an argument available. There's language in Title VII that says it protects even non-theistic, and that means you could not even have a belief in God. But if you have moral and ethical beliefs about what is right and wrong that are held with the strength of traditional religious views and that go to ultimate concerns such as life and purpose and death, now, what this language in Title VII has done is, in a sense, to extract kind of the essence of these same kind of issues that are addressed by religions, organized religion, and basically said you don't have to be associated with an organized religion. You don't even necessarily have to have a belief in God. That these kinds of beliefs, moral and ethical concerns about what's right and wrong, going to ultimate concerns, life, purpose, and death. Well, I mean, those are the types of things that organized religions address. But the law has taken the essence of that and said, this is what the law means by religious in nature. So religious in nature, that phrase takes it outside of the world of organized religion. Now, what I mean by that is, of course, organized religion is included in the legal definition of religion, but so are beliefs that are the same nature as the beliefs in organized religion, even though they're not connected with organized religion. Well, here's the point I'm getting to, Rich. It is a medical and legal fact that vaccines injure and kill people. The federal government's paid out $2.5 billion over the last 25 or so years. And what is that, an average of $100 million a year, something like that. And we have both government and non-governmental agencies estimating that 90 to 99% of the adverse events from vaccines never even get reported. So we really have no idea what the scope of injury and death caused by vaccines is, but we do know that vaccines do cause injury and death. It's a medical and legal fact. And clearly, that medical and legal fact could be, for many people, an issue that raises moral and ethical concerns about what is right and wrong, that go to these ultimate concerns of life, purpose, and death, and that are held with the strength of traditional religious views. So there is a clear legal argument that the issues about vaccine safety can be, maybe not necessarily are all the time, but can be directly involved in beliefs that are protected religious beliefs under Title VII, federal civil rights law. So the issue is definitely not over, and many of these nurses were filing complaints with the EEOC, which is their next formal available formal action, and we'll have to see how these cases play out with the EEOC before we see what goes on. You know, I don't wish a lawsuit on anyone, Rich, but I would love to see this issue in front of a federal judge. Because
exactly.
Again, you know, it's always a roll of dice for the judge. I can argue both sides of this particular point. I can also say, well, legally, vaccines are safe and effective. You know, vaccines, for example, vaccines have to be licensed by the FDA before they can be administered anywhere in the U.S. Well, once a vaccine is licensed, it's presumed legally to be safe and effective, or it wouldn't be licensed. Now, I'm not saying I personally believe that, because I don't. But as a matter of legal analysis or legal status, a licensed vaccine is legally presumed to be safe and effective. That's one of the points of the licensing procedure. If the vaccines aren't safe and effective, they supposedly don't get licensed. So as a matter of legal status, vaccines are safe and effective. So I can argue this one on both sides, and it would be interesting to see what a court would do with this. But this is an issue that, as you were saying at the top of the hour, Rich, this, we're not going away. We're not going away. This issue is not going away. And all the propaganda in the world is not going to convince us that we're wrong or convince us to shut up. So this issue is going to go forward until it gets fully and thoroughly and formally addressed at all levels, and all the corruption is exposed, and all of the potential healing that's available is set in motion. Again, I don't wish a lawsuit on anyone on a personal level, but I would love to see this issue in front of the court, and I hope we do at some point.
Well, Alan, listening to you speak about Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, it seems like that language and that logic would justify a universal philosophical exemption to vaccinations.
Well, the fact that vaccines, you know, a very simplistic but powerful and profound philosophical concept here, Rich, any product that carries with it a risk of injury and death, and that is about hypothetical future concerns, which is, you know, what routine immunizations are about, should never be mandated absolutely anywhere under any condition. And when you have to choose between risk of injury and death or whether or not to join the herd, it just shouldn't be there. The rationale, vaccine issues are such interesting issues because everywhere they show up, they are unique in the legal or medical world. And it's just so fascinating to me that that's the case. And people, what sets vaccines apart from other medical procedures which are not imposed and forced on us, now there are other situations where medical procedures are imposed on us, don't get me wrong, but vaccines tend to be unique, and all this falls back on this so-called herd immunity theory. Well, you know, your vaccine protects other people, so you don't get to decide for you because your decision affects other people. That's the whole mentality about why vaccines get to be forced on everybody. Of course,
is there something comparable? You know, you just brought up an interesting point. Is there something comparable that is mandated so that you're protecting others? The only thing that I can think of off the cuff is just the seatbelt laws. But
Seatbelts aren't for protecting other people.
Smoking because we're protecting secondhand smoke. So in most places, public places, you can't smoke. But that's stopping somebody from doing something, not forcing somebody to do something. So it's kind of an opposite action. Is there something else that we have established in government that forces somebody to do something above and beyond their wishes for the benefit of the community?
Well, we have minimum sanitation requirements, for example. But, you know, you raise a really good point in prohibiting smoking versus forcing a vaccine. And the smoking is something that has an immediate effect. You know, when you smoke, the smoke comes out of your cigarette and out of your mouth, you know, right there, here and now. Vaccines, again, are, for the most part, are addressing hypothetical future exposures.
Right.
So it gets a little more tenuous. And there was, I was just reading the first part of an article recently, which was underscoring the idea that since vaccines are not addressing a present health condition, you know, you're not treating someone who's sick or ill with a vaccine, that's all the more reason why we should be extra vigilant about making sure they're safe and effective and much slower to be talking about imposing them as a requirement. You know, really good points.
Another question that I have is, it seems that because this is almost like a medical procedure, when you go to the drugstore or the department store or your work space, and you get the injection, there should be a medical doctor on hand to make sure that you don't have an immediate reaction, although you cannot see hours later, days later, weeks later, those types of reactions being under the supervision of a physician. But it seems like you go now anywhere and get a vaccine, an injection, but you don't really have a medical supervisor who could take care of an emergency that would occur.
It is a concern. And granted, the severe immediate reactions are ones that, for the most part, happen a very small percentage of the time. But what's a pharmacist going to do if you go into anaphylactic shock? I mean, presumably, I say presumably, but I don't really know with any certainty, they are trained. You know, they're made aware that it's a possibility and trained about what to do if that happens. But I don't know. I mean, it raises a really good question. It's sort of like, why would you introduce a new meningitis vaccine into a rural African population where there's only one doctor around and not even readily available? It just, you know, none of this makes sense.
So does this kind of say that meningitis vaccine was not properly tested? Or is it the fault of the transportation? Was that the reason that they're saying that was a problem?
I don't think the article tried to identify the exact problem. I think it just pointed out a series of a list of unfortunate situations and circumstances. I don't think I don't expect we'd have any clear follow-up saying here's exactly what went wrong and how and why, but we did have conflicting information about whether or not and what storage was needed, information about the lack of availability of immediate medical follow-up and parents being paid to be quiet, all of these things, and then the whole underlying poverty conditions being ignored and come in with a medical procedure rather than addressing the cause of the whole problem in the first place. All of it, you know, just stinks.
Mm-hmm.
Be a polite word for it.
Right. At the end of the day, you know, no matter what happened, we have 40 paralyzed children, right?
Right. So.
Did you have other news that you were going to be talking about? Because there are so many different things going on right now. I had sent you a whole bunch of videos and news items that you can either talk about, or we can just give the link to that information for on Homeopathy World Community, January 10th, 2013, with the list of items. Maybe
we're down to our last few minutes here. I thought maybe we would try and do a little speed walk through just a quick summary touching on several different articles, just because there are so many of them here. And, of course, folks can go to the PandemicResponseProject.com news page to link to these and other vaccine-related articles to see the more get more details. But there was one particularly interesting article I saw recently about a boy in New Jersey who was not allowed to go back to school because his parents wouldn't get the flu shot. And the reason they would not give the boy the flu shot is because he had an egg allergy. And the legal requirements for a medical exemption were more restrictive than that. And the parents basically said, we don't care what your restrictions are, we're not giving our kid a shot. You know, do you wait and have the kid to have some severe allergic reaction before you say he can have the medical exemption? You know, this is not the sort of thing where you wait until after the fact to deal with it. You deal with this sort of thing proactively. We're talking about a child's life and health here. And so the child was kept out of school, but there was great follow-up news. The New Jersey Department of Health revised their policy to accept egg allergies as a basis for medical exemption, so presumably the boy can get back in school. So a small but mighty victory in New Jersey.
Great.
Richard, Deb, do either one of you want to chime in with another just real quick news item for us here, see if we can squeeze in
well, there's
in the
this
last few
one
minutes?
That I had. Do you have something, Rich?
Well, I can keep talking about other articles, but if you have something, please go ahead, Debbie.
I put a link at the bottom of the page. It says connection between non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and vaccines. And this is on the Gaia Health. Heidi Stevenson, who is the author there and maintains this website, says that a recent study holds information showing that vaccines may be fueling the massive increase in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a cancer that directly attacks a primary part of the immune system. And we know that this disease has doubled between the years of 1975 and 2007, a time she's kind of making a correlation, a time when vaccinations have been massively increased. And she's trying to find, to figure out exactly why, how she can make that correlation. She says a new study which just crossed her desk appears to point the fingers at vaccines, though that wasn't, of course, the intent of the researchers. They were simply looking for the best timing for the PET scan, the PET CT scan after the H1N1 swine flu vaccine. Let's see, she says, the name of the study, quote, the incidence and intensity of F-18 FDG uptake after vaccination with H1N1 vaccine. It was published in the Clinical Nuclear Medicine Journal. Questioned how long flu vaccines interfere with the results of positron emission, it gets scientific, tomography computer, so that's the PET CT scan in cancer patients. So they're obviously specifically studying the cancer patients. A type of FDG, fluorodeoxyglucose, is used in PET scans to diagnose and to find cancers. The combination of fluorine and glucose allows the scanner to see where the glucose metabolism is high, which is where cancer tends to be. And when you're talking about glucose, you're talking about sugar. So that's why we always tell folks who are not doing well with their health to cut back on sugar, especially cancer patients. However, inflammatory and infectious lesions tend to cause FDG to collect in those same locations, resulting in false positives for cancer on scans. The researchers examined the scans of patients who had recently received the GlaxoSmithKline H1N1 vaccine. It's called the Pandemrix, which includes the adjuvant ASO3. And ASO3 contains an artificial vitamin E. It's, you know, we tell you to take vitamin E. It's really good for you. But you want to take the real natural vitamin E. This is so this vaccine, the ASO3, contains artificial vitamin E, DLA tocopherol, polysorbate 80, and I believe that polysorbate 80 has been associated with illness as well, and squalene, something else that's been associated with illness. Other vaccine ingredients include formaldehyde, sodium deoxycholate, and sucrose. Oh my goodness, it sounds like quite a mix of not so good stuff for you, and they put it right into your body. The authors found a high rate of FDG avid lymph nodes after the immunologic H1N1 influenza virus vaccination. That is, the lymph nodes of the people who'd recently had the F1N1 vaccinations were significantly affected by the vaccine. And so the conclusion of the researchers is, quote, "We suggest that this finding in combination with increased activity at the ipsilateral intramuscular injection site is a strong indication of vaccination-related reactive lymphadenopathy." And if you can translate that, it means
yes,
that...
Yes, please do.
it means that, you know, our lymph nodes, which are all over our bodies and collected in particular places like under the arm and in the groin area and in the throat area, those lymph nodes are our body's filter for proteins and other toxins. They help to, they're part of the immune system, help produce the white blood, help with the white blood cells and the fluid in the body. And we know that when you get a test for the spreading of cancer, you always look at the lymph nodes. And if a lymph node has cancerous cells, we usually take out the lymph nodes. And so what they're saying is that they've found increased activity in at the ipsilateral intramuscular injection site, a strong indication of vaccination-related reactive lymphadenopathy, and we're talking about non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So diseased lymph nodes. Lymph nodes are part of our body's filtration system. The vaccine adjuvants put the lymph system under excessive stress by having to detox all of these adjuvants. And so the question is whether vaccinations, extra stress on the lymph system is fueling the highly increased incidence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. At this time, there is no definite answer. So a lot of things, we're looking at correlations and hypotheses. Let's consider the rate of increase in this kind of cancer from 75 to 2007. In a Townsend letter, that's T-O-N-S-E-N-D letter, in an article called The U.S. Cancer Program and Specific Types of Cancer, 1975 to 2007, A Failure Part 2, the authors analyzed the incidence and mortality rates of U.S. cancer during those years and found that it had increased by 91%. And so if you want to calculate 75, 85, 95, 2005, it's 32 years In 32 years, this disease, which is quite devastating to the human body, was increased 91%. And let's so do you see a correlation happening?
Come on and wrap up for us because we're out of time here. But
okay.
I wanted to give Rich one more opportunity as well before we close down to mention any other news items there. But
I'm good, Alan. Thanks for having me on. I definitely see a correlation in what Debbie is talking about, and so we'll just have to take it up next time because I know we are out of time.
Well, Debbie, it was wonderful having you here. I know we were uncertain about that in the first place, you being out of town, and it's real difficult for folks traveling to continue with a lot of the routine activities, and so delightful to have all three of us here with three different sets of information and perspectives, and just a wonderful conversation and discussion today. Debbie, you want to have any Rich, thank you for filling in for Debbie, even though Debbie was with us today anyway. Delightful to have you, as always, Rich, and I look forward to having you back again in the near future. Debbie, you want to have any closing remarks here before we close down?
I just want to thank everyone and have a great weekend. We will be back on Monday on the Health In Show. We're going to have Wendy Hewlin. She is called Homeopath to Stars on Twitter, and she's been part of a homeopathic family for a number of generations, and you're going to get to hear her story. And otherwise, we will be back on regular schedule next Wednesday. And Dr. Adil won't be back until February, but I will fill in for him on Wednesday at 10:30 a.m. And on Thursday, we'll be back again. And, Rich, you're welcome to join us. You know, call in, and if you have news or something of importance or just want to chat with us, we would love to have you back.
Well, thank you, Debbie. I'll do that.
Great.
Great. Great, that's terrific. Well, we're going to go ahead and close down. Then next week on the Thursday Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S., I believe we have Greg Glazer with us, who's with us about once a month, constitutional law attorney from California. You don't want to miss that, folks. So we'll see you next week. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Think of us together, like people everywhere. We dream about a world at work where people really care. Our paths and our lives are for us. Our journeys can't be ended. So they do what we bring us, the wisdom. Allow our souls to shine, reaching for the great new love and healing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be your world. One by one, we are changing the world. Girl.